My name is Shredda, and this is The Lightner Side of Things, Practitioner Perspectives in School Psychology, a place for school psychology practitioners to come together and share experiences and insights about their work. I am speaking with Brittany Johnstone. Hi, Brittany. How are you?
I'm great. How are you today?
Good, thanks. Awesome. So tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of the setting that you practice in and your training.
Sure. So I work in Baltimore, Maryland, and I went to grad school in Denver at the University of Denver. I completed my internship in the 2015-2016 school year. I worked half-time in schools and half-time at the Department of Education in Colorado, which was a really exciting experience. And currently, I work in a large urban district. I'm starting my fifth year of practice this year, which feels very surreal. And throughout the 5 years, I've always worked pre-K through eighth grade. My first 2 years, I was in three schools, and then I got upgraded in my third year, and I only had to work in two schools. So I continue to work in two schools. They're two great little communities, and I feel really lucky.
Nice. So you mentioned you work in a large urban school district. Tell us about what your role there has included and just a little bit about that experience. What are some of the things you've learned, especially being in multiple buildings, and some of the challenges that you've come across?
Sure. So I feel very, very lucky to get to work kind of in the full 10 domains of the NAS practice model within my district. I don't really feel like I have to spend too much time in one area or another. I get to really do a full multidimensional practice, which is definitely something that I know a lot of psychologists in larger districts don't get to do. So I definitely count my blessings on that front. Working across multiple buildings, you know, my biggest asset is my time management and organization skills. And I kind of live and die by my Google Calendar telling me where to show up every day. And I think my favorite part about working in the district that I work in is the diversity of family experiences that you come across when you work in a large urban district. My families have so many different backgrounds, and I just feel really honored to get to be part of their students' journey through school. I also appreciate that my district, all of my colleagues are really kind of alongside of me and alongside our students and our communities fighting the systemic inequalities that our students face. And there are always ongoing projects and campaigns to make sure that we are supporting the families and students and fighting for the 21st century education that they deserve and that we should be providing them, whether that's looking at access to technology, access to high-speed internet, and arts integration, culturally responsive curriculum, restorative practice, community centered schools. There's always kind of a niche that you can find and get involved with that kind of enhances your work as a school psychologist.
That sounds wonderful. So you mentioned fighting systemic inequalities. Let's talk a little bit more about that and about equity in education. What are some of the ways that you've worked for more equitable student outcomes? And I know you've been a big proponent of speaking up for your students and for, you know, fighting systemic inequalities. So what does that look like now? Or what do you think that will look like in the future for school psychologists as we kind of go through this cultural shift and have this national conversation about race and anti-racism and social justice?
Definitely. You know, I think for me, kind of first and foremost, it's making sure that we're advocating for a role and that we're not letting ourselves be siloed off. So, you know, my district, like many, has been slowly working on supporting implementation of MTSS and RTI as a way to decrease inappropriate or disproportionate referrals to the IEP table. And I think that work is very important in making sure that as a school psychologist, I'm understanding kind of what I'm doing pre-referral to support students. I've been lucky in the last 2 years of my practice in my district to work on my district's early intervention project, where school psychologists, along with speech language pathologists, occupational therapists, social workers, and general education teachers, support students in pre-K through second grade to target their academic, social, behavioral, fine motor, speech language, whatever needs they might have to hopefully give them the skills they need and build them up so that we don't have to see that student at the IEP table further down the line for something that we could have addressed with intervention or in the early grades. So that for me is kind of a big component of it is, as a school psychologist, what am I doing to make sure that I'm kind of building equity in at that level? And, you know, kind of then it's shifting to what am I doing in my interactions with students that centers their needs and that enables them to be the best advocates for themselves? Because I really do believe that by building up and honoring student voice and student input, that I am being the best practitioner that I can be. So that might mean in my direct services that, you know, we're talking about what is restorative practices and what is restorative justice so that the student can advocate for themselves if they find themselves at the suspension table or, you know, for some sort of disciplinary infraction. They have the language to assert what they need in the process and what they need from the adults around them so that we're boosting their skills that way, not just looking at like, how do I control what happens when you get upset and how do I make you aware of how your body responds to anger? But then after the fact, how do I give you and support you in learning the language to advocate for yourself and what you need throughout the school day?
Awesome. I love that you talked about it from both the systems level and then also the individual student level. Sometimes we kind of get put in one or the other and not really look at it, look at the whole picture.
Yeah, definitely, for sure.
Equity, of course, is important to school psychologists. And I wanted to highlight something, your Twitter bio, if that's okay. If you only care about equity in the classroom, you're doing it wrong. Is that what you meant, looking at kind of the systems level, but then also working with individuals?
Yeah, definitely. You know, for me, it's kind of about embracing the challenge of making sure that my practice and my activism doesn't just stop at the classroom or the schoolhouse door. It's about extending beyond into the neighborhoods and communities that my students live in, that I live in, and making sure that I'm understanding that, you know, all of the things that I know are an issue, whether that's housing access, access to affordable living, affordable wages for work, you know, all of these things, healthcare, food apartheid, food deserts, students are bringing that into the classroom with them. And if at some level I'm not working as a human being to address those issues, then I'm not really doing everything in my power to affect change for the students that I work with. I think it's hard because our roles are so complex and multifaceted to say like, hey, school psychs, we have to do this one more thing, which is to tackle all of these systemic inequality issues outside of the school building. But it is like my deeply held belief that if we don't start to kind of stretch outside of the school building and look at what's happening in our neighborhoods and look at what community organizations are doing, that we're never going to get to the root cause of what is making life difficult for so many of our students.
Yeah, kind of looking at it from that preventative perspective.
Yeah, and it's definitely not glamorous. You know, I spend more evenings than not on, you know, Zoom calls, or before the pandemic, it was at community meetings and in meetings with different organizations. But, you know, for me, this is it. You know, I've had that in my Twitter bio for maybe like 6 or 7 years now, and I just never take it out because it truly for me is about addressing equity, not just inside the classroom, but beyond. And I think sometimes in education spaces, we get caught up of what we can control within the school building that we neglect attending to the things outside of it. And, you know, we really have to kind of look at the whole world that students and kids are living in and how we can affect change there.
So I want to talk about a NASP early career spotlight piece that you worked in.
Mm-hmm.
In the interview, you stated, one challenge that I face in my practice is feeling like the tools I've been trained to use are not designed to actually improve the lives or educational outcomes of the students I work with. What did you mean by this?
Yeah, so for me, that statement came from, you know, having been in the field for, at that point, was I was starting my fourth year when I was writing those responses, and just kind of feeling lost. Like, I knew where to go to look for curriculum and intervention programs, but I wasn't seeing my student population reflected in maybe the norm samples for different curriculum programs. And, looking at the tools I had to assess academic progress and the curriculum that my students were receiving not being culturally responsive in a way that it should be, just kind of feeling at a loss that I was like, the curriculum's not meeting their needs. My intervention programs, I keep feeling like aren't going far enough or aren't grounded in the research that I've been taught is so important. And then I have these assessment tools that, the field is starting to and kind of continues, not starting to, they've been doing it for a long time, but continues to highlight as falling short of what we kind of the standard that we hold them to. The almighty, FSIQ and all of the numbers that we rely on, when we start to dig down, they start kind of fall apart, and the research that's been showing that we might be over relying on the numbers as a way to make ourselves feel like we're affecting change. So just yeah, feeling really kind of like I was struggling with what my practice was, what I was doing day to day. Was I actually helping anybody in my practice? And I think some of that is like the imposter syndrome that comes up as you start to kind of try to assert your professional identity and feeling like you just don't know where to turn to for answers. So it definitely was like kind of a dark moment in my career. But there was ways that I was able to find community and find people who were much smarter than me, to provide support and guidance on where to go next.
Yeah, I think that sentence really stuck out to me for that reason. I think it's very relevant to our times today. All school psychologists are very highly trained. We have wonderful training programs, but we're in a time where we're suddenly coming to the conclusion that we really need to do more with anti-racist practices, with culturally responsive practices, with social justice initiatives. And I know that's been in the field for a long time. It's not new necessarily, but I think a lot of school psychologists on the ground who've just up until these past few months have been going to work and just doing their daily tasks did not really think in those lens. It was definitely a piece of our practice, but I don't think it fully encompassed our entire practice and the lens in which we view our students and our systems. And I think that's shifting now. And a lot of psychologists are, we're starting book clubs, we're getting involved in different initiatives, doing lots of PDs, having difficult conversations. And so I feel like it's definitely a time of reckoning almost, and there is a shift right now.
Yeah, there really is. And I'm, so grateful to see that happening. For a long time, for several years, I found myself seeking training and professional development opportunities outside of the field of school psychology because I was seeking that understanding of anti-racism and social justice and how to do that hard work of equity analysis in schools and in our programs. And I wasn't finding that as strongly and solidly in school psychology as you can today. And so I'm so grateful for the researchers and practitioners who have really pushed the field and been relentless in making us and the making us as the as school psychologists see that this needs to be kind of coming from inside our own house. And while it's great that there's trainings and programs for teachers and everybody else, we need to kind of do the work as school psychologists, and it should be coming from other school psychologists.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about your work with your local teachers union. Tell us about what inspired you to get involved and the type of work that you're doing.
Yeah, so I got connected with a group in my teachers' union called the Baltimore Movement of Rank and File Educators, or BMOR, in 2018. At the time, it was a small but mighty group that was doing some amazing advocacy work within union spaces, as far as advocating with state legislators and medias around issues that our students and educators were facing. And it kind of came to a boiling point for BMOR in 2018 when we came back from winter break in January 2018, and Baltimore had a really bad cold snap. And many of our buildings' boilers that had been off for the winter break were struggling to come back online. And so our buildings were freezing, and we, unfortunately made the news with a lot of sad photos of like kids sitting in their coats and classrooms, and just looking at the pictures, everything looked freezing cold. And BMOR was really at the front and center of advocating for the buildings to close for student and staff safety, which is, we never want to close school buildings, but there comes a time where it's the hard choice that has to be made because of the safety issue. And so I was like, oh, those are the people I need to be, in community with and organizing alongside. And I really haven't looked back since then. And in spring 2019, there was an election for the t leadership in my teachers union, and BMOR ran a slate of candidates, and we ended up winning the union presidency and about half of the seats on the executive board. And I was honored to have been voted into union leadership by my fellow teachers union members. And so we've been working just about over a year now, since last May 2019, on, kind of bringing our vision of what the teachers union can be. And that's a vision of bargaining for the collective good. So not just bargaining for our contract and our labor rights, but what can we use our collective power as educators and as members of a union to bargain for the collective good of the communities that our students and our schools are in. So whether that's bargaining for things like affordable housing, right now we're in a pretty intense campaign with Comcast to try and get them to improve their Internet Essentials program so that it meets the needs of students during this virtual learning period.
Oh, that is amazing that you're doing all of that work. I don't think it's unusual for school psychologists to be involved and have leadership positions in their teachers' union, but we often, I think, feel we're not represented appropriately still. Why do you think that is? Why do you think school psychologists often kind of feel left out of those talks, or their concerns are left out of those conversations?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a sentiment that's probably widely held. And I think it's rooted in the fact that our role can be so isolated at times. If we're often the only one of ourselves in a building, there may only be a couple dozen of us in an entire school district. We may be working across several school districts in some of our more remote areas that do kind of cooperative school districts, where it's one psychologist for several different smaller districts. So it can be hard to build community, and community is kind of the foundation of organizing. And if you don't have that community built, it's really hard to stand up and fight for yourself alongside others. And so for me, part of getting involved with the union was having a really great vocal community of other school psychologists around me saying, when I went to them and I said, "Hey, does this sound right to you?" And they were like, "No." I was like, "Well, let's do something about it." Or let's like send an email to the union and say like, "Hey, what are you doing to address this need for school psychologists?" And I could CC a couple of people. And even just that act of having a few people having my back kind of gave me the push to speak out and seek support on whether it was working conditions or contract language. One thing that we fought for recently, unsuccessfully, but it was still a good learning experience, was we were trying to get a stipend for school psychologists in the district who held an NCSP, because we do go above and beyond continuing education requirements to hold that certification. It is, a financial investment in getting to have those letters after your name, And we thought that if school psychologists in the district were going above and beyond to meet that standard, then You know, we should be stipended for it, just like teachers who hold a nationally board certified teacher certification. We weren't successful in getting that into the contract this time, though I remain optimistic as always. But it was a good learning experience for school psychologists in the district that, you know, we can pick an issue, organize around it, educate our peers, get other service providers on board with supporting us, and assert that this is something that will make our practice better for ourselves, because we will have more people invested in staying in the district because they're being rewarded for meeting this higher standard of care.
Nice. I like that you talked about community. I feel like that's really, really important. Whether it's on an association board or with the teachers union or elsewhere, you know, it's one thing to believe in a cause or have ideas, but it's another to be surrounded by those who are like-minded and willing to take up the cause with you. So I think that can be very empowering.
Definitely. And it's really at the foundation of so much of kind of what we inherently do as school psychologists. You know, we pride ourselves in making sure that our students have the skills they need to be successful in the communities that they're going to, whether they already are in or that they're going to go off into in their future. So we already have that like inherent, intrinsic desire to do this work. It's just kind of about reorienting who's at the center of it and putting ourselves at the center of the work, which feels uncomfortable sometimes because we are very selfless people. But, you know, we cannot be our best selves if we're not attending to our needs. And sometimes that looks like saying, hey, you know, I need to know that there's proper protective equipment and safety protocols before you're going to ask me to do in-person testing in the middle of a pandemic, which is one of the other things that we're working on right now.
Right. I mean, that said, I have to ask you about leadership as well. When it comes to leadership, what would your early career psychologist about how much they should get involved, what they should pick and choose to do? I know oftentimes some people, psychologists will say, don't say yes to everything.
Yeah, that is definitely the danger of saying yes all the time. For me, it comes down to, I mean, first and foremost, you have to kind of get your work life in order, because people will allow you to step into leadership spaces and make space for you if they feel that they can trust you to take on that extra responsibility, I feel. And so if you don't kind of have good routines and practices in your work life, then you're going to set yourself up for failure, and you're going to open yourself up to a lot of risk, because inherent in leadership is taking risk, because you're a vocal and prominent face in your community, whatever community that might be. And if people can find things that you're not doing well when they disagree with you, they're going to use that to kind of discredit whatever you're working on. So for me, it's really about making sure that you have your daily practices and routines really tight, so that you kind of have the freedom to be loud and vocal at times. Because it's, then people can't critique you and say like, oh, but you didn't turn your paperwork in on time, or your reports are always late. It's like, make sure that stuff is in order first. And that might take you a couple years, and that's okay, because you're growing and you're learning along the way, every step of the way. And then once you have that figured out, then you can kind of start to open your eyes and say, like, what can I say yes to, or what opportunities are available to me?
Speaking of being vocal, let's talk about social media. You are very active on social media, and that's actually how we met. And you're not only active about school psychology topics, but like you've already talked about, you're active about local community issues, about politics. And I don't often see that type of social media activity from school psychologists. I think many are uncomfortable talking about things beyond school psychology. They may be afraid to cross the line and appear too political or too opinionated. Was it a conscious decision on your part to use social media the way you do?
You know, I don't think it ever was like, I don't think there was ever like a fork in the road, and I was like, well, I can kind of just keep tweeting about this, or I can like jump off the deep end and go this way. I'm a pretty like stereotypical internet millennial, and in that I was like raised on it. So I've probably always been oversharing about myself, whether it was like MySpace or Tumblr. Now it's just like Twitter and Instagram. So it's just like, you know, evolving over time. And I'm actually pretty like shy and introverted if you meet me in person. So I've always kind of appreciated that social media gives me a space where I can say out loud what I would usually only say in person to like my close friends and people I trust. But being myself and speaking out about things is kind of something I've always done. I used to write letters to the editor when I was in high school, which is like a total nerd moment. But now I can like, instead of doing that, I just, you know, can make a Twitter thread where I can combine research and personal anecdotes and calls to action and loop in people who are doing work and boost their platforms with whatever, you know, tiny sphere of influence that I have. So I don't think it was ever a conscious choice, but it's definitely, there have been moments where I've had to kind of check myself and say, like, am I getting too far ahead? Am I getting too far outside of my limit? But you know, I kind of look at it that I'm outside of work and inside of work, I am a whole human. And if I'm asking students and families to bring their full selves and humanity into the work, then I should too. And that means that sometimes I'm going to be loud about housing conditions because the houses that are being rented to the families I work with have lead in them, and that's unacceptable. And so I'm going to have to be loud about that because I can't just sit quietly when these unacceptable conditions are being, are apparent, you know.
Keeping with, you know, the idea that school psychologists should be thinking beyond the schools, should be thinking about their larger communities and the systems in which they live and work and their students live and learn in. Do you think social media plays a part in that, and that more school psychologists maybe should be more vocal on social media about topics?
I think it does play a part, kind of going back to what we've been talking about as far as community. You know, I'm lucky to work in a district with, you know, over 150 school psychologists, so I can find that community among other school psychs pretty easily. But if that's not the situation that somebody finds themselves in, if they're in a smaller district, social media can be a great place to connect with people and you know, share research or share ideas or share projects that you're working on. And so I think that community-centered aspect of it is very important. I don't think it's going to be the right thing for everybody, just because, you know, I would never say that there's one right way to do activism. There's no one right way to be a school psychologist. If social media makes sense for, you know, the work that you're doing and kind of making your efforts broader known across either the city or the state or the neighborhood you're working in, then that can be great. But I don't, you know, I don't think social media can ever really replace in-person connection and organizing. But it is an invaluable tool, especially if you're in a situation where you don't feel like you can make connections with other educators or other school psychologists as easily in person as you could online. And, you know, I think it's, we kind of joke about like, oh, I know you from Twitter. But you know, that means that we've had some conversations, that I know some things about what you might believe and think about different issues. And you might know some things about what I think and believe about different issues. That means when we meet in person, we kind of have that small talk out of the way, and we have a bond already over something that we might have shared on social media, and we can kind of dig into conversation deeper right off the bat, which is something I like when I like run into people at NASP or other conferences and I was like, oh, I know you from Twitter. It's like, you know, I kind of feel like I know this person already, and it's like a homecoming almost.
Well, I can definitely say that I feel more inspired to be more vocal on social media after kind of watching how you speak on social media.
Yeah. And, you know, I hope people feel inspired. You know, there's also, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that there are times that I maybe have walked the line or crossed the line even with being vocal. I have been in situations where I've received professional feedback for things that I've said. And, you know, it wasn't great to have my supervisor pull up tweets that somebody had sent to them, complaining about what I had said, like in a meeting. But ultimately, you know, I have the right to speak up as an individual, and I also have a responsibility and an ethical and professional duty to advocate for what's best for my students. And sometimes that means I like might draft a message and then walk away from it because I need to marinate on whether it's if it's right to send right now or it's prudent or appropriate to send. But if I come back to it and I'm like, nope, that checks out, I still think that, I'm willing to stand on that ground, then, you know, then I'll hit send and just, you know, be prepared to defend my stance if it comes to that.
Right. The key is just don't be impulsive.
Yes, that's definitely the advice is take time to digest, because the internet does live forever, as they say.
Yes. So lastly, as we prepare to begin the new school year while the pandemic continues, thoughts, worries, or reflections, what's been on your mind?
Yeah, my thought is that we have the opportunity to really think creatively about what school looks like. And I am not, you know, team like revolutionize the schools and reimagine schools in some, you know, way that means we never go back to school buildings. But I do think that we have the opportunity to kind of think critically about what our students are learning and what they're exposed to and what we value as education. And I'm seeing a lot of on social media about, you know, well, students, if they're not exposed to their teacher for 6 hours a day, they won't be learning. And I think that it like is really grounded in a deficit model view of what our families and communities have to offer our students as far as educational experiences. So I'm really trying to think flexibly about what activities my students might be taking part in or what I can support families in doing during this time of school building closure in my state to impact their educational experiences. My worries are for the students that are difficult to reach and how I continue to kind of build relationships with them. I'm starting in a new school building this school year. And so the idea of kind of building relationships with the staff and students and families when they don't know me from in-person time of our lives and only being virtual has me kind of deeply worried, but I also kind of view it as a challenge to be the most outgoing, impersonable, impressionable person I can be so that they know who Miss B is, whether they've met me in person or not.
Right. Thank you so much, Brittany, for talking with me.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to share my little corner of the world with the people.
Thank you so much for listening to The Leitner Side of Things. If you have any feedback or topic ideas, let me know on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @SGERA99. See you at the next episode.